Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to cleanorigin.com. Founded by a leading family in the diamond industry for more than a century, we're experts in lab-grown diamonds because that's all we do. Clean Origin, the only diamond jewelers who give you a 100-day, no-questions-asked return on your purchase. Head to cleanorigin.com or one of our retail stores and mention code RADIO10 for 10% off your purchase. That's cleanorigin.com, code RADIO10.
When it comes to the highest places on Earth, the Rockies, the Andes, and of course, the Himalayas come to mind. And while hikers have scaled these peaks, real-time weather data is scarce at these high altitudes. These are not highly populated areas, so why would we need to have weather stations installed in these remote frontiers? Joining us today to explain why and what it means for not only our understanding of the present climate, but the past as well, is National Geographic Explorer Dr. Baker Perry. Welcome and thank you for joining us, Dr. Perry. So good to have you on the Weather Geeks podcast.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invitation. I'm excited to talk more about these exciting topics.
Yeah, this is going to be a good one. We've got a lot to cover. So I'm meteorologist Jen Carfagno. I want to start with, how did you become a weather geek? It's the first question we ask every guest on the show. And in your case, it's kind of a combination weather / geography geek.
Yeah, in my case, I was, I can really point to three places, experiences that were so formative. The first was just growing up as a small child in Portland, Maine, and experiencing some pretty severe New England winters and blockbuster snowstorms as a kid. And while I was living there as a kid, I became fascinated with the weather conditions and current observations from Mount Washington. And I would have my NOAA weather radio on and, would hear the 100-mile-an-hour winds and 40 below, and just my parents tell me that just really got me very excited. I certainly have memories of that as well. And then our family moved to 13,000 feet in Peru and also in Bolivia. And I spent some of my formative years of my childhood there experiencing some severe thunderstorms that would put down, in some cases, 10 to 12 inches of hail. And we would get snow, we would get flash flooding. A lot of the roads that we drove on didn't have bridges. And so we were heavily impacted by the weather just with our daily transportation. And of course, the mountains and glaciers were right there. We had peaks up to 21,000 feet, very close by. And we would take family hikes and outings up to as high as 17,000 feet. So I was always kind of captivated by the mountains and the weather. And then my family was originally from North Carolina. And after we lived in Bolivia, we moved back to the mountains of North Carolina. And if snow was in the forecast, I was setting up my tent and camping out in the front yard. That was just how I was wired. And there was one particular event during my middle school years. This was April 2nd through 5th. So this was an early April snowstorm, 1987. And we had a track meet that afternoon in Hendersonville, south of Asheville. It was in the upper 60s. And by the time we got back to school, 9:30, 10 o'clock, it was already snowing. And we picked up between 2 and 5 feet of snow in early April out of this blockbuster storm. And so that was very formative. There were several other big storms during my college years. Of course, I got to experience the blizzard of 93. And so it was a combination of places that I live and just memorable snowstorms, I think, in particular, that really set me on the path that I'm on now.
Listening to that, I think it's literally impossible for you to have been anything else other than the explorer and geographer and meteorologist that you are. You seriously have trained your whole life for what you're doing. I'm going to run through some of your background for everyone who's listening and watching on our streaming app. So right now you are professor of geography and a National Geographic Explorer, which we're going to get to later in the show. Your research interests include alpine precipitation formation, snow and ice, precipitation glacier climate interactions, and high elevation weather stations, which leads me to share that you've either led or co-led 23 research expeditions, along with local collaborators, to install and maintain 11 weather stations above an elevation of 5,000 meters, which is 16,000 plus feet. And when you said that you spent, you know, a lot of your childhood above 13,000 feet, right away I was like, well, this explains it, you know, because 16,000 feet, most people can't imagine spending a lot of time there, let alone doing what you're doing at that elevation. Let's see, in 2022, you led two National Geographic and Rolex Perpetual Planet expeditions, one in southern Peru, Nevado Asangante, and that was up above 20,000 feet, more than 6,000 meters. Another to install the highest weather station in the world just below the summit at the Bishop Rock, above 8,000 meters, and maintain other stations installed before. You also co-led the National Geographic and Rolex Perpetual Planet Expedition to the Topongato Volcano in Chile that installed the highest weather station in the Americas in February 2021. And you have over 30 years of alpine mountaineering experience that includes the installation of a weather station at the balcony on Mount Everest in Nepal, elevation 27,600 feet. That's more than 8,000 meters. It's quite a feat. We're going to talk about more of this. The weather station in Peru, Bolivia. I mean, it goes on and on. And, you know, maybe I'll talk more specifics about this coming up. But before I finish your background, I got to add this one more point that you've slept at elevations above 5,000 meters. So that's above 16,400 feet on 134 nights and above 6,000 meters on 17 nights, which again, when I hear what you described as sleeping out in the snow during a snowstorm in your, you know, formative years, then this explains a lot of what you do today. First question is just why? What drives you to do this?
Well, that's a great question. I think initially when I got involved with weather stations, I had just finished my PhD. My PhD dissertation focused on snowfall in the Appalachians. And as part of that process, I recognized that we didn't have many observations at the highest peaks of even the Appalachian Mountains, the Southern Appalachian Mountains. And so that got me on a path to better instrument some of the higher elevations and especially improve the quality of precipitation and snowfall measurements. And then I had this, of course, connection with the Andes, and I had lived there as a child and had started taking students there in 1999. But when I mentioned this interest to one of my committee members on my PhD, and this was a former climatologist, he's retired now, he responded very quickly and said, well, that's good and well, but while you're here, you're going to do snowfall in the Appalachians, and then you can do whatever the heck you want to when you finish. And so that was he was a little more direct perhaps than I would have appreciated, but it was probably good advice overall. And so once I finished my PhD, I did begin to build collaborations with other researchers in Peru and Bolivia in particular, and again, recognized that there was a huge unknown. There was this real lack of observations, just basic meteorological observations to help better understand the processes that were driving the huge changes in glacier area, just the deglaciation that was occurring. And of course, there's the really important connection with water resources. You've got major population centers in the Andes, such as La Paz, Bolivia, Cusco, Peru, that are heavily dependent on the meltwater that comes down from those glaciers. And I mean, to me, it was also personal. I had been to some of these glaciers, including Chacaltaya Glacier, which used to be the highest ski slope in the world when the glacier still existed. I would go there as a kid. And that glacier completely disappeared in 2009. And so I had seen some of these changes firsthand, and that was part of the motivation to go back and really try to improve our understanding of precipitation and the timing of precipitation and how much is falling as rain versus snow at the elevation of the glaciers and the type in terms of the habit, whether it's grapple or snow or mixed rain and snow. So there's just so many unanswered questions there. And that's what brought me into the weather stations in South America. And I was fortunate to receive some funding from the National Science Foundation. It was an NSF career award that allowed me to install two high quality stations, one at Chocultaya, which is where the glacier had been that I used to go visit as a kid. And our partners at the Maine State University in La Paz have a research station there, a research observatory. It's the highest one in the world. And so we were able to install this high quality precipitation station there. And we also installed one just below the summit of the Quelccaya ice cap at 18,500 feet. So that was my real start into high elevation weather stations. And then as I was finishing that project up, an invitation came from the National Geographic Society to join this expedition to Mount Everest in 2019. And at the time, I wasn't necessarily looking to expand to the Himalaya. I mean, I had plenty of work and still data to analyze and papers to write from the Andes. But I mean, the opportunity to work with National Geographic Society and this incredible interdisciplinary team of researchers and to work on the highest mountain in the world was hard to say no. And yeah. I had grown up, of course, fascinated by not only the Andes, but I remember reading books about Mount Everest and certainly the early exploration and the polar regions too. And so there was clearly a fascination that I had in high mountain and polar regions in addition to just the weather. And so, as you said, it's interesting to see how things have come full circle.
Yeah.
And now I've been working on Everest for going on 5 years now.
Yeah. So that your expedition there to install weather stations on Mount Everest was actually on the front cover of the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society in December 2023. So just the recent December issue. I remember seeing that on the front cover and I was like, wow, who's going up there to install weather stations? Was literally my thought. Like, that's quite, because, you know, doing work like that, even at, I don't know, a 2000 feet and in regular conditions can be tough and challenging because of the equipment and the challenges just go along with that. So you basically climbed Everest to install weather stations. So let's dive into that one. And you know, you talked about why you do it in terms of looking, knowing what's happening now so that we can understand what has happened in the past. But there's almost two angles or approaches you can take, because we know we need to have better data about what's happening right now to just make a better day-to-day forecast. And then the other is that we need to have better data about what's happening now, what has happened, so that we can look to the future and try to figure out what trends are happening. So, I'm thinking about all the climbers every year that attempt to summit Mount Everest, and they really don't have much real-time weather data. So what was the main driver for you for your expedition to install weather stations on Everest?
No, absolutely. I think you did a great job summarizing that. I mean, Clearly, the big picture was the focus on water resources and improving our understanding of the current climate and how that has impacted the glaciers in the region, understanding how that has changed in the past. And then with that information, we can improve projections for future water resource availability, because these are the water towers of Asia. The Himalaya sustain hundreds of millions of people downstream with the water resources. So I think that was clearly the main motivation for scientifically and from an impact standpoint going to Mount Everest. And with Mount Everest being the highest peak in the world, it is iconic. It is, everybody knows what Mount Everest is and where it is. And so it has, it's very significant in that sense. But as you point out, the weather is a very important part of the story as well, because historically, bad weather, we believe has contributed to about 25% of the fatalities on Mount Everest. And there have been some attempts to install weather stations. The Italians had a station at the South Col at just under 26,000 feet for several years, but it's very challenging to maintain that. And you know, there have been some stations lower down where it's more accessible, but this was the first, you know, really comprehensive effort to go above where anybody had gone before with the weather stations, and that was motivated by improving our understanding of climate change, water resources, and improving weather observations, weather forecasts, and with the direct result of climber safety. And the majority of the people on the mountain are Sherpa. They're the ones that carry the loads. They make multiple trips up and down. And so that was a particular motivation, is to improve the weather forecast so we can make everyone's jobs, and especially the Sherpa, jobs up there safer.
How did you prepare for this expedition, and how many were on your team, including Sherpa?
So the 2019 expedition, we had over 30 scientists on the team. The vast majority did not go above base camp, but above base camp, there were three of us that went above Camp 2. There was another snow scientist that had made it to Camp 2, and Inka Koch did some work there. So there were three of us that went above Camp 2. I think we had five media team members as well, and a team of 10 or so Sherpa that were critical in not only moving the equipment, carrying loads up and down, but also completing a lot of the installation. We had worked with them intensively, not only in the weeks leading up to the expedition, but also the month of January of 2019. Several of us had gone to the Everest region, into the Khumbu, and had spent time training with our Sherpa team. That included just basic components of the weather station and how they work, how to set them up. We practiced and discussed anchoring, drilling bolts, and anchoring the legs into rocks. We climbed ice. We were very fortunate to have legendary climber Conrad Anker with us on that expedition, and giving us tips and teaching us the finer points of staying safe and climbing ice and some of these frozen waterfalls in the Khumbu. And from a preparation side too, this was just this incredible group project, because we had to constantly interface with the engineers and programmers at Campbell Scientific. They're the ones that that built those initial stations that we took up high. And there were just lots of people involved in this. And it was an incredible challenge. We were definitely constrained by time, because the assignment, the directive we've been given by the National Geographic Society, is this had to happen in 2019. And so it would have been nice to have a little more time to plan and prepare, but in the amount of time that we had, we did the best we could. And then in between of all of that, we were doing our best to train and prepare physically for the challenge. And what that looked like for Tom Matthews, my main colleague from the UK, who co-led the meteorology team with me, Tom and I were spending 15 to 20 hours a week just getting in as much volume and vertical elevation that we could in preparation for the expedition itself. So there was a lot to juggle and balance. I mean, fortunately for me, I obviously had previous alpine mountaineering experience and was comfortable with crampons, ice axe, with the basics of mountaineering, and had spent time at high elevation. And so there had, to a certain extent, I had been preparing for this for much of my life, but it's a little different going above 21,000 feet and having to depend on supplemental oxygen. We started using supplemental oxygen at 23,000 feet and then actually having to maintain dexterity in our fingers and try to still have a high level of brain function at these elevations was a particular challenge as well.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, this is quite the story. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk more about any pitfalls that you may have encountered and find out how you knew the equipment was going to work in those extreme conditions. So we'll take a quick break and then we'll be back on the Weather Geeks podcast.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
The new Super Beats Heart Chews Advanced is now supercharged with CoQ10. Support your healthy CoQ10 levels and blood pressure with 2 chews a day. Visit RadioBeats, BEETS.com, and save 15% with promo code DEAL.
Welcome back to our Weather Geeks podcast. I'm meteorologist Jen Carfagno from the Weather Channel hosting today, and I've got Dr. Baker Perry, who is professor of geography and a National Geographic explorer. And we are talking about his expedition to Everest to install weather stations. And you just shared the training that you went through trying to, I mean, and not just you, because as you said, you really have kind of prepared for this thing your whole life. But I can't imagine there's a large pool of people that are in the type of shape and mindset to do this kind of work. Are there?
It's a select group. There are other people and colleagues that I work with around the world that can do this, but it's not a large group.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, no, I imagine. It's like it's an elite group that are able to do this type of thing. And you had weather equipment that, you know, was designed to work at this altitude. How do you test it? Because these are extreme weather conditions as well as extreme elevation.
Well, yeah. I mean, so the sensors that we were limited to using were those that were commercially available, just given the time frame. And so even though a wind sensor has been wind tunnel tested to 300 miles an hour in some cases, does not adequately prepare it for the extreme cold and the force of the wind and the changing wind direction and the turbulence and the eddies or the small rocks that get picked up and blasted against it or the rime ice that can form on the sensor. So there's a lot of real world conditions that a lot of these sensors had never experienced necessarily. We did some cold testing to temperatures as low as, I think, negative 45 for the data logger, for a lot of the sensors. But, you know, we didn't know how things would hold up, to be honest. And we were told by the Italians that had installed the previous highest weather station in the world that their sensors and their station was destroyed by small rocks being picked up by the wind and just blasted against it. And so we tried to go, well, we did. We went higher, a little bit higher than their site, and to try to get out of this loose, smaller rock. And we were sensitive to that. But I had no idea how long these higher stations would last. I doubted they would make it through the winter the following year. And one did not. The balcony station succumbed to just, you know, extreme winds. The South Call station, that next highest one at just under 26,000 feet, made it through the winter, but the wind sensors were totally destroyed. And the last recorded measurement was 150 miles an hour with a temperature of negative 40. And so there's just huge strains, and at those low temperatures, you know, it just puts a, you know, a huge strain on the materials that are used for them. So there were, I mean, we had some challenges for sure.
Yeah. You know, were there surviving. any pitfalls in the installation process?
On the expedition itself, there were lots of challenges we faced. Of course, just the altitude, and it takes a cumulative toll just being up there, whether you're breathing supplemental oxygen or not, and it's really hard to sleep at nights. And so there's this cumulative stress that builds up. And so we're trying to work our way through that. But in the installation itself, at the balcony, which was the highest station we installed that year in 2019, we had two major challenges. The first of which, we get up there and we're ready to drill the holes in the rock for the bolts to anchor the weather station to the small piece of exposed rock there on the balcony, and the batteries were too cold. We had done our best to keep them warm, keep them in our sleeping bags and keep them warm. But even so, it was 22 below Fahrenheit when we were working up there, and the sun hadn't come out yet, and they just had no life. So we got a quick plan in place, and with several of our Sherpa, we began warming them up under armpits and in other spots in our down suit. And after about 45 minutes, we were able to get them just warm enough to complete the drilling for the installation and mounting of the tripod. And then the second major challenge that occurred was we had, you know, nearly completed the entire installation of that station. Again, this is at 27,657 feet. The sun had just risen, and we were nearly complete, just lacked putting on the wind sensors, on the top of the station. And we realized that the pipe, the short 12-inch section of pipe that the wind sensors mounted on, was that it didn't make the load that the Sherpa were carrying up. So we had six different Sherpa just carrying up the weather station.
They forgot a part?
Well, it's not on them. It was on you.
Yeah,
probably
yeah.
More on me,
yeah.
Because I should have been triple checking those loads the day before, but yeah. I had been sent out by our biology team to go take some soil samples at the South Call. These are some of the highest soils in the world. And that took longer than expected. And I should have been triple checking the loads, but we had just completed that installation at South Call. And there were lots of parts floating around. And so those those pipes did not make the load. And when I realized that, I remember sitting there on my pack, just very frustrated. I think I might have been hitting my head or hitting my helmet, you know, just out of frustration, because this is one of the most important measurements we wanted to have were the winds. And so I started looking around and saw that we had a collapsible avalanche shovel that, you know, we carry with us, and it's very important for snow safety, but also we had to clear some snow off the rock. It's like, wow, you know, that handle might be the right diameter. And so sure enough, we were able to use both parts of that handle as the mounts, and we got the wind sensors installed. Amazingly enough, even though the tripod and the whole station had been toppled by these extreme winds, the shovel handles had held. The wind sensors had been destroyed, and the station had been destroyed, but the shovel handles were still there. So that was not the weak link in the installation.
That's a good advertisement for that avalanche shovel. That's amazing. Tell me about what data then you did get, because I know you got some data about precipitation as well too, right?
So we have precipitation gauges at the two lower stations, one at Fort Say, which is 12,500 feet, and then one at Everest Base Camp. We don't have any precipitation measurements above base camp, just because of the logistics and lack of space and the wind too. When the wind's that high, it's just nothing's going to fall on the gauge anyway. But what we've learned from base camp is that there's a lot of rain that falls even at that elevation in the heart of the monsoon, and that was certainly a surprise to see, because there are these massive glaciers that come through the valleys, and yet the bulk of the precipitation in the monsoon, this is in the summer months of June, July, August, and September, is falling as rain. And it's not much above freezing. We're talking 35 to 40 most of the time. But we really think this is a recent phenomenon with rising freezing levels and just much more rain falling in these Appalachian zones and these zones of the glacier where there is melt that occurs. And that's a relatively recent phenomenon. And of course, it's not good for glacier health if it's raining on them as opposed to snowing. And so that's a pretty important finding just from the precipitation observations that we have so far.
Yeah, most definitely. This whole thing is fascinating. You've learned so much, and the expedition itself is just a story in its own. We're going to take another quick break, and we come back. I'm going to ask Dr. Perry if they considered actually making the summit all the way to the top, and also what it takes to become a National Geographic Explorer. We'll be right back.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome back to our Weather Geeks podcast. Meteorologist Jen Carfagno from the Weather Channel, along with Dr. Baker Perry, who is professor of geography and also a National Geographic Explorer. So let's start with that question first, which is, how did you start working with Nat Geo? It's one of the oldest brands that I can really think of. 1888 is when they first started publishing their magazine here, and it's certainly well known and recognized for the work that they do. How did you become a National Geographic Explorer?
Well, that's a great question. And as you say, I mean, the National Geographic magazine has been around for so long, and I have lots of early memories of spending hours on my grandparents' floor going through their old National Geographic magazines just in their bookshelves. And so those really helped expand my understanding of the world. And I was particularly captivated in some of these high mountain expeditions. And so the opportunity to come back and work with National Geographic has been a real highlight. And for me, the opportunity came because I was already doing similar work in the Andes with these weather stations. There's only a handful of people around the world that have worked at these elevations, specifically with weather stations. So that is how I ended up on the expedition in 2019, and then became formally a National Geographic Explorer and invited to participate on these other expeditions. So there is a more formal application process, grant submission process that many National Geographic Explorers go through, but there's this other pathway that if you're doing some of the work that they're interested in supporting, that through the networks, it's possible to find.
Yeah, congratulations. Congratulations. It is quite an honor, and it's very impressive and just plain old cool, to be honest. Just quite cool. So when you guys were on Everest, had you talked about wanting to summit?
So in 2019, the original plan was to put that highest station just below the summit at a place called the Bishop Rock. And then plan B was the South Summit, which was a little bit lower down. And then plan C was actually the balcony. And so that was our third option. But because of the weather, I mean, we can kind of blame the weather that year, 2019, because there were not many summit windows that had opened earlier in the month of May, which meant that when the weather windows did open, for our team, they opened for everybody else, and everybody on the mountain was trying to get to the summit as high as they could. Nearly everybody there was going for the summit. We didn't necessarily have the summit as our goal, but we wanted to get as close as we could to put this highest weather station. That meant that there was this intense traffic jam with hundreds of climbers trying to navigate these one-way sections of rope. And it was slow going. And so our lead Sherpa, Hanru Sherpa, was very concerned because we were stuck behind this long line of other climbers. And so when we topped out at the balcony, we got everybody together and Hanru made the call like, hey, this is as high as we're going to be able to go today. There's just too many other people ahead of us. It's not safe to go on. And of course, we had limited supplies of oxygen and time to do the important scientific work that we did. So that's why we stopped this balcony in 2019. And so, sure, I mean, there was a part of me that was like, gosh, you know, it would have been nice to go up a little higher and even potentially make the summit. But But in the end, we weren't there to summit. We were there to complete these scientific objectives, to try to install the station as high as we could, and to get everyone down safely. And so I am thankful that our leadership, our lead Sherpa Ponnuru in particular, had the experience and the confidence to make that call. Now, we did get a chance to go back in 2022, and our team did succeed in installing that station at the Bishop Rock. And I stayed at Camp 2 on that particular expedition because we'd already lost a couple of Sherpa due to health concerns, and so we were understaffed. And again, due to changes in the weather, we made a collective team decision that we needed to go light and fast in order to make this happen. And so I sent the team on. My colleague Tom Matthews was with them, and our Nepali glaciologist Arbindra Khadka, and they completed the installation of the Bishop Rock. The Sherpa, our lead Sherpa on that expedition, Tenzin Gyalzin Sherpa, had to strongly encourage Tom to just get him to go to the summit, which was not that far away. But again, the main motivation for us is to keep these stations working as long as they can and to bring everyone back safely. I was back on the mountain last year, 2023, and climbed up to our station at the South Col and completed essential maintenance there and had an opportunity to go higher up to the Bishop Rock. But in the end, again, it was a matter of resources and expediency, and our Sherpa team was able to complete all the tasks that they needed to on their own. And if I had been with them, I would have slowed them down. So that's part of the calculus in these decisions, is just figuring out collectively as a team what needs to be done on these stations, what resources we have available, and then trying to do so in a manner that that makes sure everyone stays as safe as possible. So
that's
maybe one of these years I'll have that window to get up on the summit. But if not, I'm at peace with that as well.
Yeah, well, you've had quite the experience, but that's an amazingly generous attitude that you've had throughout this entire process, because, but putting the data and the others on your team ahead of yourself is just fantastic. And I'm not sure everyone would do that, right? Now, do you think that you will ever attempt to summit just to, not necessarily to install or check on weather data, just to do the climb?
It's hard to say. I mean, it's quite possible that an opportunity will come up to just be there for, I wouldn't necessarily call it fun, because it's not fun up on those elevations. It's you don't sleep well. There's a lot of suffering that occurs, but I wouldn't rule it out at all. I mean, it's certainly Everest and the people that we work with, the Sherpa community in particular, have grown on me tremendously in the past 5 years. And so I do feel more attachment to that place and to those people. And so there is a certain draw that I suspect will keep me coming back.
Yeah.
Even if there's not a weather station to maintain. But in the meantime, we're doing all we can to keep these stations operating as long as they can in the best condition they can, and learning from the failures that we've seen and trying to take small steps to improve the network. One of the major challenges that you alluded to early on is that in places like Mount Everest and many other high mountain regions around the world, you only get a short window once a year to go and see what has happened or do the maintenance at all.
Yeah.
And so it's very difficult until we actually go there and see the current condition of the weather stations to know exactly what needs to be done. Certainly we can monitor some things via satellite telemetry with the data transmissions and know when a sensor goes out, or for example, when the station may stop transmitting completely, but that only gives us a small picture. I mean, even at the, say, for example, Mount Washington in New Hampshire or some of the most extreme peaks in the Rockies, if a sensor or a station goes down, usually within a week, somebody can get out there to survey what's happened. That's not an option in these places. We get on Mount Everest, it's one shot a year in May, and there's just a lot of educated guessing in between what might have happened. And so it really extends the time horizons for being able to make repairs and improvements for the next year. So it's a long process.
What is the next expedition that's on your docket? Is there a next one outside of Everest and outside of some of the work that you've done in the Andes?
Well, there's a number of expeditions in the works and in kind of the proposal stage. And so I don't have any details to share on that, but I can tell you for sure that I am going to be leading a group of students from Appalachian State University as part of a summer study abroad program to Everest Base Camp in May and June of this year. And part of the responsibility and task of the program will be to visit our two lower weather stations in Fort Say in the Sherpa community and also at Everest Base Camp and complete some maintenance activities there. So that's the most definite. I also have an expedition to return to Peru in Usumacinta later in the summer, most likely August, to do some basic maintenance on that weather station that we installed as well.
So
there's gonna be others more than likely, but I don't have details to share at this point.
Well, that's exciting, and I can guarantee that if we've got any similar meteorology mountaineering peer enthusiasts that are listening here, they're gonna put their application into Appalachian State so they can join your team to get there to the base camp. Just to get back to current events real quick, because since you're, a mountain weather guy, I just got back from the big blizzard in the Sierra, and it was very interesting watching that on so many different levels, especially because, speaking of levels, how elevation mattered so much here. Tell me what your thoughts were on the blizzard and watching it unfold.
Well, I had a bit of jealousy seeing you out there in all the snow and reporting live and taking measurements. I definitely enjoy big snowstorms and especially just the meteorology, the changes you see in the snow crystals and the degree of riming and the wind. And so I think, part of me is like, gosh, I wish I had been there. The other part is that it just continues to amaze me how much snow can fall in the Sierra Nevada out of a single storm with these big atmospheric rivers. And that, of course, we're nowhere near the amount of snow that fell last year up there over the course of the winter, but this was a blockbuster storm. And so it's just, I think we all have that little kid in us still. They're just like, wow, that's impressive. I think on a larger scale perspective, I think there are other places around the world that, for example, the Chilean Andes that also experience these sorts of atmospheric rivers and can get incredible amounts of snow. But we don't have the population up there and don't necessarily have the stations to record it. And so I still continue to be fascinated by just extreme storms and mountain regions and just clearly it seems that there are some of these big storms are having huge impacts, and there is a very interesting story to that, and
mm-hmm. yeah,
the hydrologic cycle and the fact that you get these long snowless periods and then these intense storms coming through, and so how that relates to changes we're experiencing in our climate is
yeah.
a very active research topic. So I think there are lots of interesting angles there.
That links up exactly to the very work that you are doing. Really enjoyed this conversation, Dr. Baker Perry. What is the best way for someone to follow you or your research? Social media?
Jen, this has been a real pleasure to be here. And yes, I'm on social media. I'm not as active as you, but trying to take some tips. I'm on Twitter, X, as Baker Perry One. I'm also on Instagram, but I do communicate a lot of our scientific findings on my X Twitter account. So look for me there. And I'm on the Appalachian State University website. And if people want to follow up with additional questions, you can look me up there and shoot me an email. And happy to correspond or send me a message on Twitter. And would love to continue the conversation.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. And everyone who is watching or listening, thank you for joining us on this edition of Weather Geeks. We will see you next time.